It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A hot labor market may show signs of cooling. The Labor Department announced this week available jobs dropped in October. As the Wall Street Journal put it, workers quit quitting and landing a job is harder after a layoff. We take stock of these economic conditions and how Wisconsinites may feel about these times. And you can join the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Heather Long is a columnist and member of the Washington Post's editorial board. Heather, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks very much, Kate. Good to be here.
Well, running the numbers here, it suggests the American economy is remarkably strong. Economy grew by 5% from July through September. Consumer spending up more than 3%. Unemployment has been under 4% for almost 2 years. What is your take on the strength of our economy?
It's certainly been a miracle year. I keep calling it the economic miracle of 2023. It's almost laughable when you look back at headlines a year ago that there were so many predictions coming into 2023 that we were going to have a recession, that things were really going to slow down. And instead, not only do we not have a recession, a lot of things have accelerated. You just mentioned growth in the third quarter above 5%. We normally grow as an economy in the U.S. around 2%. So this is like getting an A++ here in the third quarter on the report card. There are always some signs of strain. I don't want to belittle those. Obviously, inflation running around 3%. We'd like to see it running around 2%. Many of us can quote prices that are still higher that really frustrate us when we go to the store. But by and large, the big surprise this year has been two things. Number one, workers still getting jobs, not quite as fast as 2022. But number two, the biggest surprise of all is people kept spending, specifically Americans. When people say, why is the U.S. economy so much better off than Europe or Japan or Canada or elsewhere? It really was American spending on those Taylor Swift concert tickets or movie shows or going on a big vacation, maybe to Disney World or New York City or somewhere else overseas. And it just really didn't slow down.
And that's such a head scratcher there. Why are people buying more if prices have kept going up?
Yeah, it's the eternal question that's debated in economics. And the best answer is people really saw their wealth and their savings in their bank go up during the pandemic, which is not what anyone would have expected initially. But obviously, people weren't spending as much for those first year or two when they weren't going out as much. There were those payments from the government for people on unemployment or for people who were receiving those stimulus checks or stimulus payments, as they were called. And so a lot of people were able to build up savings. Of course, they didn't have to repay student loan payments for a number of years. And so that you could see it. You could see it in the data, this buildup in savings, and people have been spending down that savings here in 2023. So it's sort of been a splurge year, a year to kind of put the pandemic behind us and treat yourself. And a lot of people did treat themselves, whether it was continuing to buy. We've seen strong sales of apparel and toys this year. Even jewelry, which is something that you usually don't buy unless you're feeling a little bit splurge-like.
But polling doesn't really reflect quite that rosy optimism. There was a November poll by Marquette Law School found more than 70% of Wisconsin voters think the economy is poor or not so good. And national polls have found similar pessimism. Why is there such a disconnect between how economists and how Americans view the economy?
Yes. This one, there's a lot of theories on. I look forward to hearing various callers' ideas on this as well. The obvious, easy answer to give is what you were just saying. Prices are higher. We can all probably quote some prices that we know are a good bit higher. Overall, across the economy, prices are up 20% since pre-pandemic. So that's if you average all the different prices increases, you get about a 20% higher situation than across than what we were experiencing in 2019 or early 2020. And we can all see that. We can feel it when you're looking to buy a home or buy a car, or when you're just going to the store and buying meat or buying some clothes. You can really see those increases. And you know in your mind, gee, I used to be able to get, you know, two steaks for the price of one, or I used to be able to get a lot more than a house value than I can buy today. And so that's kind of the easy explanation for what's going on, is that there's a huge psychological impact. Of course, as a nation, we hadn't seen inflation like what we experienced in 2021 and 2022 since the early 80s. A lot of people weren't even alive at that point, if you're from a younger generation. And so this was a real shock, and that shock has lingered. The other thing that what will be interesting is, generally speaking, in polling, people change their views and reassess after about 6 months. Huh. And so we really saw that dramatic decline in inflation this summer. And so now we're starting to get to that 6 month period. And so the polling hasn't improved, and the political polling, as you've just cited from the Marquette poll. But we are starting to see some glimmers of an uptick, not huge, but starting to see a little bit of a rebound in some of the consumer sentiment. So when you take politics aside and just ask people, what do you think of this economy? You're starting to see a little bit more of an uptrend, but it should certainly be higher traditionally and historically than where it is now.
We have a Washington Post columnist, Heather Long, as we look at perceptions of the economy and the latest figures. You can join in. Questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Heather, as we talk about prices and not being able to buy as much as you think you should or that you have in the past, I always wonder, why does the Federal Reserve prefer like a 2% inflation target? Why is 2% such a sweet spot for the Federal Reserve?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's certainly a lot of debate about whether 2% is the right number, or, you know, how they got to 2% was a little bit, you know, I don't want to say they totally took it out of the air, but it wasn't exactly some precise science. Wasn't Newtonian physics. But I think where what's important to know is, why don't you want zero? Why don't you want no price growth? And the reason you don't want a situation where you have no price growth or even negative, some people are sitting here saying, well, why can't the prices fall back down? And you don't want that throughout the economy, because that basically means you're in an economy that's contracting. Hmm. And so in order to have a growing economy where people's incomes are going up, where the we're adding more value across our economy, where small businesses are going to be having bigger receipts that year, you do need a little bit of inflation going on in the economy. That's sort of been, that has been like a Newtonian physics of economics, that you do need to see a little bit of inflation. You can argue if it should be 1%, 2%, 3%. But generally speaking, that's the idea, is that if you actually saw flat or negative price growth, you are generally in a recession situation.
Washington Post columnist Heather Long tracks the economic indicators, interprets the anxiety Americans feel about their finances and future stability. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Inflation is slowing steadily. The Treasury Department says at a faster rate than other advanced economies. But Americans don't seem to feel it. A Morning Consult poll finds prices are a major concern, as we've been talking about. Call in with a question. You can share your insights. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Heather Long, columnist and member of the Washington Post's editorial board. Heather, as you look at it, is the Federal Reserve doing a good job of managing inflation without stalling economic growth or causing a recession?
I think the fairest way to say it is they were too slow in initially. So everyone kind of agrees that they were very slow to start to raise interest rates and respond to the inflation that we were seeing in 2021 and certainly by early 2022. Then they acted very aggressively starting in March of 2022. We all know they went from almost zero interest rates up to over 5%, and we can certainly see that in mortgage costs and in business borrowing costs. But so I'd say they got a slow start, but they picked up fast. And what they did do a great job of in the past year, you can't knock them for this. They have restored a belief that we will get inflation down. They've said it every chance they have, every speech, they sort of look you in the eye and say, we are committed to doing this. And they backed up those statements with those actions by hiking those interest rates so quickly. So in that sense, I think they've done a pretty darn good job. And now, how much credit do they get for this miracle we've seen in 2023 of being able to bring inflation down without having big job loss or a recession? That's a more interesting question. What you're starting to see, and I think this is probably the best answer right now, is the biggest contributing factor to bringing inflation down wasn't the Fed. When you raise those interest rates, what you're really telling people to do is don't go out and spend. And actually, we saw a lot of spending, as we were speaking about earlier. People have definitely been spending this year.
Inverse, yes.
Yes. So, it wasn't so much the Fed action, with the exception of the housing market slowing down, that slowed the economy this year. It was really, to be honest, and just a really basic unwinding of the pandemic. It turned out that our inflation that we were all experienced and really don't like was mostly driven by supply problems, right? The prices were going up because we couldn't make enough cars during the pandemic, or because we couldn't get the cabinets or the toilets with all these people remodeling. We couldn't get them to the US fast enough and get them where they needed to go. And so the prices were going up. And the same thing was happening on the labor side. So many people obviously lost their jobs initially in the recession, and then we had to get people back to work. But people wanted to go and work in different jobs. There was a lot of quitting, the great resignation, or I call it great reassessment of work going on. And so it just took an awfully long time. It's took two and a half years to unwind all of that and get back to something that was more like business normal conditions. And so that was probably the biggest impact. And when people ask me the same question about the White House, well, how much impact did President Biden have? I kind of say the same thing as the Fed. Okay, he did a few things to help around the edges, particularly at ports and making some of the a little bit easier to bring some goods in that were getting stalled at ports. But by and large, the real credit here, probably goes to simply this getting back to normal, unwinding the end of the pandemic effects.
Let's take a call now. Landon in Spring Green. Landon, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, I had a quick question, sort of building off where this conversation is going about, you talked about voter sentiment earlier and about how people seem to be rather unhappy with the economy, even though the dollars and cents and the reporting shows that we are doing better, we're spending down our savings, all that stuff. I do wonder, I think the public has gotten a lot of information about the record profit margins that large corporations have made off of inflation the past couple of years, whether or not it was driven by supply crunches or just because they knew they could get more money out of people. I think that may have a larger, more specific answer when we talk about voter sentiment. I'd like to know if there's any data on exactly what kind of the profit margins look like after operating expenses for people who are already exorbitantly wealthy, just becoming more exorbitantly wealthy. I think that's been a real concern for a lot of the public.
Landon, thank you for bringing that. Heather, go ahead.
Yeah, he makes a great point. I mean, certainly in early 2022, we saw there was a quarter that had record profit margins, well, record since ni the 1950s. So there was certainly some there, some data to back up that feeling that the corporations were doing some price gouging. It sort of depended by industry. what you were seeing. Certainly, some industries obviously have more pricing power and ability to do that than others. I will say you could argue that's the flip side, that that's why we're seeing some prices fall incredibly quickly this year, is whatever power they did have now that supply chains have been worked out and that customers are starting to look more for deals, particularly this holiday season. You are starting to see some very quick price drops and some much more steep discounts. So we're you know, if you believe what Landon was laying out, I think we're also seeing the flip side of it, and that's actually helping inflation come down more at the moment as competition is back in many industries. But I do think the point he brings up, I wanted to add one more thing in our conversation. Some of the polling recently has broken down by age, and you see, generally speaking, retirees rate this economy way better than people who are in their 20s and 30s. And I think that a lot of that, starts to unpack these perceptions of unfairness in the economy, which have been there for a long time. But, if you were someone who wasn't able to buy a home or a car because you didn't have enough savings and you're just starting out in your life and your career, and you're in the 20s and 30s, it's really hard now. It feels like the door was slammed in your face, that suddenly, how can you buy a home with the home prices at this level and the mortgage rates so high? And so I think that dynamic we need, will need to be thought through a lot more about the impact and the generationally that this is all having on younger Americans.
We have the Washington Post columnist Heather Long tracing perceptions of the economy. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Jimmy now in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi, what's on your mind?
Morning, ladies. Well, I just wanted to make the comment that, I mean, gas prices in Wisconsin anyway are below $3. I know the interest rates are a little high right now, but I recall when I built my house in 83, the interest rate was 13%. So it can obviously get a lot worse, and they're coming down. So I think it's unfortunately divided between who supports President Biden and who supports the Republican side and Trump. But I think if we're in the same shape as we are right now, next fall, I think people are going to go into that voting booth and vote with their wallet. And unless something catastrophic happens, I can't imagine people wanting to go back to the chaos that the Trump administration carried out for 4 years. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thank you for calling in. Heather, how big of a role do you see economic issues having in next year's presidential election and in the voting booth?
Well, the typical answer is, economics is always the number one issue. But I think this past midterm election really questioned whether that would be the case, that a lot of people were voting more on social issues, such as abortion, than they were on economic issues. And so, or as the prior caller was saying, on sort of your beliefs about the future of the nation and the direction we're headed and democracy and sort of the character of the person in the White House and leading the country, than it is so much about economics. It's interesting too, the caller made a good point, Jimmy made a good point, that if you ask people specifically, do you like, say, the infrastructure bill that was passed that's helping to put more money into roads and bridges and fixing old pipes in places like Wisconsin and Michigan and my home state of Pennsylvania? People say yes. They like individual policies. Or did the stimulus payments, for instance, were wildly popular under both Trump and then President Biden. So if you ask on individual policies and sort of individual things that are happening in the economy, most people are pretty happy with those. But when you ask overall, do you like Bidenomics, for instance, that's where you start to get a lot more negative ratings. And so, for whatever reason, the White House tried really hard this summer and into the fall to increase its economic messaging. They sort of thought that they had a messaging problem, that they just needed to be out there talking about the economy more. But unfortunately, there does seem to be some perception where people are just a little bit hesitant to see President Biden as an economic leader, even if they like his individual policies.
In our final 30 seconds or so, what indicators or messages are you watching most closely as we head into the new year?
That's easy. The number one indicator to watch right now is anything about the labor market. We got the jobs report on Friday, and every Thursday you have the jobless claims. So those are people who are newly filing for unemployment. And you've really started to see an increase in people staying on unemployment, which indicates it's much harder to get a job if you lose your job. And those are early signs that things are shifting.
Heather, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Good conversation.
Heather Long is a columnist and member of the Washington Post editorial board, former economic correspondent for the Post. We continue this conversation ahead, exploring recommendations for a people-first economy and what that could mean for Wisconsin and the nation. Call in with a question. Add your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get insights now on how the economy operates as the American Academy of Arts and Sciences releases a report with recommendations on how to create a people-first model. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question, share views along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy Kramer is a political science professor at UW-Madison, a co-chair of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on Reimagining Our Economy. Kathy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. The commission released the report last month saying too much attention is devoted to how the economy is doing and not enough to how Americans are doing. How did American leaders lose sight of people in the management of the economy?
Well, that is a great question. And I'm not quite sure, but we started from the premise that our economy is often oriented around not how to make sure that people in the economy have everything that they need in order to thrive, but what can we do to make the economy as a whole thrive? And I loved your discussion in the previous half hour, and that disparity between, the economy overall seems to be doing great, but people don't say that to pollsters, at least. So something is off between what people are experiencing in the economy and how we think overall the economy is doing. So yes, the report was focused on how do we think about and create an economy that actually works for the people who are the part of the makeup, the parts of it.
Who thrives in the economy as it exists now? Who are the winners now?
Well, most likely the people who are earning the most money and have the most wealth, but lots of people aren't thriving. So it's no longer the case in the United States for a lot of people that working 40 hours a week is enough to support oneself and have a decent life. And that seems to be a basic premise of American life, that ought to be the case, right? That you ought to work hard 40 hours a week and be able to enjoy your family and have time, at least a little bit of time, to do the things that you love. So lots of people are making ends meet, but really not thriving in doing that, right? And by thriving, we mean having time to do the things that they care about and to contribute to their communities and spend time with loved ones.
What prompted the Academy to do this study?
It actually was a commission on democracy and how to shore up the health of our democracy, improve our democracy. And that report was called Our Common Purpose. And their discussions kept coming back to the economy, and they recognized that the health of the economy and how Americans are doing in the economy has a lot to do with how healthy our democracy is. So they created this separate commission to come up with recommendations, both legislative and just practices within various industries, that would help people have the things that they need in order to live a good life.
Because, you know, some political scientists will just stress to us now how our democracy is ailing, that it's in an unhealthy place. Can we attribute the outlook on America, our economy, to the uncertainty of our democratic institutions?
It's a great question, and there's actually some debate on this, of whether people's economic security is directly related to the ills of our democracy. But there, it does seem pretty clear that when people feel insecure with respect to being able to have enough income to plan at some length of time in the future, to be able to know that they're going to have enough to provide for their families and for themselves, that it sets the stage for people to, let's say, political entrepreneurs or political candidates to tap into people's feelings of insecurity. And it makes it more possible for people in the public to turn against one another. And that's one way in which the economy is related to the health of democracy. And also, the less that people have to do anything beyond putting a roof over their head and feeding themselves, the less they are able to turn their attention to anything beyond those needs, right? So turn their attention to solving problems with other people in their on their block, in their neighborhood, in their community, or paying attention to what's going on in the various levels of government that make decisions that affect their lives. So there's just a way in which people's having ability to not stress out about economics influences their ability to be citizens, be concerned about the broader community.
Just to get a bit of a window into the commission's work, I understand you held listening sessions with groups of Americans. Who did the commission talk to for this report?
Well, we talked to a variety of people, from people in rural communities in Tennessee, for example, and in Kentucky, to people, college students who are struggling to make ends meet, to leaders of indigenous communities, to people who are service industry workers around the country, just a wide range of people to get a sense of what is their daily life like, what are their experiences in terms of just, you know, working, trying to make ends meet again. And what do they hope is different? What do they want to see different? And what would they like their leaders to know about their lives that they don't think is being heard?
It's interesting that you spoke directly with people, and the commission didn't just use data or figures or indices, you know, to make recommendations. Mm-hmm. That it was these human stories that seemed to be guiding the work of the commission.
Well, as you know, in your line of work, right, there's nothing more powerful than a human story to really help you understand what is going on in people's lives. And so we definitely relied on polling data and a wide range of data to learn, to try to understand what are the challenges that people are facing in economic life right now. But yes, because we were focused on what are people experiencing and what can we do to enable people to have what they need in this economy, we felt it was really important to listen. And to be honest, the, those of us on the commission, I mean, it was an impressive group of people to work with, from Nobel Prize winners to leaders of business industries. But none of us have recently faced economic hardship. And so to me, it was really important that we got outside our own circles and listened hard to people from a range of walks of lives. And I would say another thing that we did that was so illuminating to me was to hire 4 photojournalists to go to communities that we identified as the median household income was at about 40% of the income range in the country. So these are people, generally, these are communities where people aren't in severe poverty, but in the middle ranges of income. And we had those photojournalists take pictures of what daily economic life is like in those places. And that, combined with having an ear to the ground, was really illuminating for both the dignity of work and just how meaningful, what a huge part of our lives daily work is, but also just how much kind of the sadness in how hard people are working, and yet how much they're lacking in having that work be something that fills them rather than wears them down.
Kathy Kramer is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. As we discuss developing a people-first economy, you can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Kathy, some of the commission's recommendations, they're bold, they're grand. Reforming healthcare, deconcentrating economic power, those are complicated things. What would it take to realize some of these goals in the United States?
Well, I could give you one example of how we're trying to put this into action. I mean, in general, we're trying to talk with people in the nonprofit sector, members of Congress, people who are involved in decision-making that can bring these things that, into reality. But specifically, our very last recommendation is about promoting economic connectedness, a very broad, perhaps ambiguous proposal on its face. But what it means is promoting interactions among people of different socioeconomic backgrounds. And it grew out of some recent research in economics showing that people who grow up in situations in which they experience economic connectedness, or again, this interaction with people of different socioeconomic backgrounds, tend to experience higher social mobility. But we value it for reasons that are, again, connected to democracy, too. So in terms of people having an ability to understand the lives of other people who come from a different walk of life. And so to answer your question, what we're doing is now we have a working group of people who in various parts of the economy are actually achieving this kind of economic connectedness, from a head of the Library Association in the United States. So libraries are one of those great public institutions where people of different walks of lives come into interaction with one another. And we're having these people share with us what they're doing that helps achieve this. And we're creating a tool that communities can use to try to promote economic connectedness. So to wrap up, lots of conversations and lots of hard work, but the report was a great blueprint that we can build on.
UW-Madison political science professor Kathy Kramer is a co-chair of this American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on Reimagining Our Economy. And there's room to talk. Call in with a question. You can share your perspectives. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the work of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Its commission on reimagining our economy advances 15 recommendations to stop rising inequality across the economy. UW-Madison political scientist Kathy Kramer is a co-chair of the commission. Call in with a question. Share thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tomas in Madison is here. Tomas, hi. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask if the guest could give her view on some of the obstacles that we're facing in passing appropriate legislation and policy. And I specifically wanted to bring up the Citizens United Supreme Court case. Thank you.
Thank you, Tomas. Citizens United bringing that up on campaign finance now over a decade ago. Kathy, go ahead.
Well, as the caller said, thank you, Tomas. Yes, there are congressional obstacles to making a change in that legislation. You said it as best as I can, that that it is definitely I don't know what to say beyond that, other than that there has clearly been repeatedly resistance to making a change in that legislation, and despite the fact that many people, majorities of people in the American public, feel that the influence of money in our elections currently is a problem and not what they want to see in their democracy.
How do rural and urban residents view the economy differently?
Well, I'm not so sure that they always do, to be honest. I mean, I have studied myself different perceptions among people in rural Wisconsin, but I shouldn't say different, but this, I've spent a lot of time listening to and thinking about how people in our rural communities feel that they're not getting what they need in order to thrive. But I would say that sentiment is not all that different from people in other places. We're very aware of how politicians have tapped into that sentiment in rural communities. But in my own work and in this commission work, it's clear that lots of people feel like the people in charge are not listening to their needs, that they don't have what they need in order to really not just get ahead, but have the life that they want to. And they often feel disrespected by people who live in other types of places who they perceive don't understand what they need. But yes, I think that sentiment of feeling like there must be a better way is felt by many people. And I'll just wrap up my response to your question by saying one thing that motivated this commission is the recognition that the economy was created by people and it can be changed by people. We often talk about it as this thing that's is a beast unto itself, but it's all the result of choices that we have made.
That's really powerful. You know, as it can be created, we can also change through policies to make it, to create what we envision. How can the economy provide a better safety net? What are the recommendations there?
Well, one in particular that's really important for the safety net is doing something to avoid what are called cliff effects, where we do have a safety net in place in many respects in the United States. But the way it's currently set up is that there's often a gap in support for people who just start to sort of pull themselves into a position where they're not so unsafe, right? That they're becoming a little bit more financially stable. And so, for example, if you earn just a little bit over a certain threshold, then suddenly your support for housing disappears. Mm-hmm. And so it puts people into a really dangerous situation where just as they start to get on their feet, they're kind of thrown off again. So that is one thing in particular that needs to be changed with respect to our safety net.
Let's bring in Alec in La Crosse. Alec, hi.
Hello. So my question is on the idea, you brought up the idea of socioeconomic connectedness or interconnectedness. Is there any play or is there any relevance to multi and single family zoning laws to that connectedness?
Absolutely. Thanks for the question, Alec. Yeah, for sure. When people live closer to people of different socioeconomic backgrounds, chances are that they're going to have more interaction. It's not inevitable though, right? So proximity isn't the same as healthy interaction in which we talk with one another and get to know one another. So we're trying to find those practices that are currently in place in different parts of the country in different communities where people don't just live with others of different socioeconomic backgrounds, but actually have healthy interactions with them.
UW-Madison political scientist Kathy Kramer with us as we look at a commission's work to develop a people-first economy and its recommendations. Join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. There's a recommendation, Kathy, to allow communities to sponsor immigrants. How would this immigration help our economy?
Well, in many communities, in many communities, immigrants are a really important part of the economy, but they often have a difficult time obtaining visas, right, to come and work in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so this is a recommendation that from this very bipartisan commission that was trying to find a way for communities to have the workers that they need and businesses to have the workers that they need and for people who want to come here to be able to come and build a good life. So it's really about the demand in our economy for people with certain types of skills and being able to meet that demand with people from other countries who want to come and live here.
In our last moments together, I just want to recognize that the commission members, they came from all walks of life. You just mentioned bipartisan, not just from an academic setting. Were there differences to reconcile in what recommendations to put forward?
Oh, for sure. We worked great together. We definitely had disagreements. For one example, we had disagreements about what exactly, whether economic inequality is the main driver of our economic problems. I would say we disagreed about that to the end. But yes, we had artists and authors and economists and people from the faith community who all had brought something different to the table. And hopefully these 15 recommendations are, they're solid because they came from such a wide variety of people.
Kathy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. And thanks for the callers.
Kathy Kramer is a co-chair of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on Reimagining Our Economy. She's a professor of political science at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.